We're going to get started. We don't yet have a quorum, but I'm going to call to order the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. Know that this is the first day that we're actually meeting a half an hour early, and so members will be coming in as their other meetings end. But with that, Representative Seifert, if you'd like to come to the table, we'll start with your bill. Members, Representative Seifert is also going to have an amendment, and he will move that after we get a quorum. But if you want to go ahead and describe the bill, Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Madam Speaker, members, this is a bill that is known as Brandon's Law. The bill is a good faith attempt by many different parties, and I want first, Madam Chair, to thank you and the Speaker for being co-authors of the bill. This bill is about adults who go missing under dangerous circumstances. It makes some minor changes in the law, but makes big changes for those families who have been affected by having missing family, friends in the community who are adults. This is not about people who are just moving around temporarily, or people who are moving because of temporary disappointments in the job market or because of problems at home. This is about speeding up the filing of missing persons reports. It's about starting searches. It's sharing information about investigations with family members who feel that they have a right to know when police believe that such sharing won't interfere with the investigation. The circumstances for such expedited searches include evidence that the disappearance is not voluntary, missing or under known dangerous circumstances, missing over 30 days. The person is under 21, so we have a little more of a vulnerable age situation. Attention for medical purposes or prescription medications, no pattern of having disappeared before. Mental impairment, possible abduction by a non-custodial parent, past victim of violence or threats, lost in a dangerous outdoor setting, or other evidence to show that the person may be endangered. Madam Chair, as part of the discussions with the Speaker, I have the DE1 amendment, which is really what the bill will turn into. As you know, it's a delete all amendment that eliminates four items that had fiscal impact that law enforcement brought to my attention, including the website, the hotline, a new clearinghouse, and the database. And those were the concerns brought forward by law enforcement that felt that the impact would be very significant in times where, of course, the legislature is short of money. I do understand that law enforcement does have some further concerns, even after the DE1 amendment, but that we are making some progress in addressing their concerns, and I do want to commit to law enforcement that I do want to work with them and the families to come up with some good policy changes that will positively affect Minnesotans who have lost loved ones. I have with me today, Madam Chair, the family of Brandon Swanson, who would like to testify. I believe Annette would like to testify. And I also have David Francis, the father of John Francis, who was lost in the Sawtooth Mountains of Idaho for over a year. And his family's private efforts, of course, brought him home. I think, Madam Chair, for lack of a quorum, perhaps we'd want to hear the testimony and then adopt the DE1 amendment may be appropriate.
That would be correct. Representative Seifert, go ahead with your testimony.
Okay. And
we can give you additional chairs if you'd like to have more folks up at the table.
Both introduce yourselves.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
My name is Annette Swanson.
My name is Brian Swanson.
Madam Chair and committee members, we are Brian and Annette Swanson from Marshall, Minnesota, and we're the parents of Brandon. I'd like to thank you all for the opportunity to talk today about Brandon's Law and about Minnesota Missing Persons legislation. We are here today because on May 14th of 2008, we were plunged into a world we wish we had never learned about. On that day, in the early morning hours, Our son Brandon went missing, and he was 19 years old. Since then, we've been trying to live in this world, a world where we don't know the land, and we don't know the language, and we don't understand the culture. But we've been trying desperately to figure it out and learn how to survive here. I will not forget the day that we were told to go home and wait. It was late afternoon on Thursday, May 15th, and we had been out searching for Brandon all day. We were numb with grief, we were covered in mud, and we were completely and totally exhausted. And at the end of the day, we sought direction from the sheriff, and we asked him, what should we do now? And his answer to us was, go home. I'll call you when I know something. I was in total shock and disbelief at that moment that I was told to go home. But I did go home. But I didn't stay there to wait for a phone call that would not come. We were out searching again for Brandon the very next day. And had I listened to the sheriff, I would to this day be waiting at home for that phone call. And I will not forget how I felt the following Friday when Brandon's immediate and extended family returned to the staging area after a full day of search to find that law enforcement had packed up and gone home. There was no communication from them. They did not let us know what would be happening next or if anything would be happening next. They had not told us if they would be back. And we were left to wonder if they were just done. In addition to being numb with grief, we were all at a loss. We were in shock, deep despair, and we were angry. We felt alone and abandoned by them. And we felt that we had no choice but to organize our own search. And so we did. We put a call out for help. And over 100 people came out that Saturday to search for our son. We were inexperienced and it was a risky move. But we could not see that there was any other choice. Because law enforcement wasn't talking to us. And if it hadn't been for Brian and I making contact with them, asking them what was happening, asking them for meetings, there would have been none. We were having to reach out to them. During this journey, we have witnessed and experienced many things. We have learned that the systems which exist and are available to us aren't connected, and too much additional burden falls upon an already struggling and grieving family. And we have learned that Minnesota does have a missing children's act. And in that act, a child is defined as any person under the age of 18 years, or any person certified or known to be mentally incompetent. That's not Brandon. Brandon was 19. And he was not mentally incompetent. And in fact, the day that I called to report him missing at 6:30 in the morning, I was asked some basic questions about why I was calling. How old is Brandon? And when I told them Brandon was 19, the first thing they told me was, you know, ma'am, he's an adult and he has the right to be missing. And I said, but you don't understand. We were talking to him. He called us, he asked for us to come help him, and we were on our way to do that when we lost contact. And we haven't been able to find him, and we haven't heard from him since. And then the next thing she said was, well, why didn't you call sooner? Because I didn't know what to do. and I didn't even know if they would take my report. Because we lost contact with Brandon at approximately
1:20.
No, 3.
3:10 in the morning.
And I was calling at 6:30. Minnesota has no missing adult legislation, and Brandon's Law will finally provide this.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record.
Brian Swanson.
And go ahead.
We have learned that federal law requires that missing children be entered into the National Crime Information Center, that NCIC, while reporting missing adults, is voluntary. This means that you report an adult child as missing. Law enforcement is not required to report this information. This is where Brandon's Law steps in. We'll correct that. Brandon's Law requires that all missing at-risk persons are entered into the NCIC, a critical step in identifying missing persons and locating their families. We are not lawmakers, law enforcement officers, or heads of commissions or boards. We are the parents of a missing adult child. In our deep grief and despair, it is painfully obvious to us that Minnesota must do a better job in searching for and reporting missing persons. The pain only goes deeper and more desperate when law enforcement ends the search for your missing loved one. When the sheriff announces the formal end of a search for Brandon, we were simply at a loss. We had two choices, except for law enforcement had ended their search without finding our son and leave it at that, or to continue our own search. Continuing our own search was risky and expensive, but desperate to find our son and for answers, we could not stop. We spent the rest of 2008 conducting our own search without proper training, support, or guidance from law enforcement. One of the many, many difficult tasks conducting our own search was going out each Saturday without knowing how to conduct the search, how to organize the information that we had learned from other searches. Sadly, organizing the information to create an instant action plan to give us direction for the next search was not being done. Law enforcement needs to access, law enforcement needs to access the search, rescue, and recovery resources to aid in conducting an extensive search, so the families are not left to search for and find the remains of their loved ones. We need to take more action to support the families in missing and unidentified to bring some peace and closure to them the opportunity to lay the loved ones to rest. The information system exists so that we can do a better job. Brandon's Law will require Minnesota management.
The information systems exist so that we can do a better job. Brandon's Law will require that Minnesota manage our critical information more effectively, to ensure the greatest possible chance of locating our missing loved ones and returning them to our families. As you know, Minnesota has a state clearinghouse for missing persons within the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Let's use, support, and staff this clearinghouse as a central information repository. Please, let's do everything we can to help families with a missing loved one. Let us not add more pain to already grief-stricken families by failing to do what's right and necessary. Families of missing loved ones need the support of law enforcement. Law enforcement needs the support of the state of Minnesota. Supporting Brandon's Law will help accomplish this. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your story. There is formally a quorum, so I'll officially call the meeting to order. And did you want to continue with the testimony, or do you want me to move the DE1 amendment?
Madam Chair, why don't we adopt DE1 so we have the bill before us, and we'll have to have a motion that the bill be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance, Madam Chair.
That's correct. Representative Seifert, I'll move that House File 1242 be recommended to pass, be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation that it go to Public Safety Finance.
Okay.
Then I would move the DE1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion fails. Representative Seifert.
Madam Chair, there's an amendment. We have DE1 that Ms. Perius prepared. It just changes a couple words, but it helps us avoid going to the Civil Law Committee so we can make the bill deadline to keep the bill moving. And she could perhaps outline that for the committee.
Ms. Perius.
Madam Chair, members, the amendment would be to H1242 DE1. On page 1, delete section 1. And on page 8, lines 19 and 20, delete the new language and reinstate certain language.
Madam Chair.
Representative Seifert.
Madam Chair, members, what this does is it takes out any reference relating to data practices, so the Civil Law Committee no longer needs to see the bill.
All right. Questions from members?
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Could Ms. Perius state the first delete all that? I didn't catch that.
Ms. Perius.
Madam Chair, members, with page 1, delete section 1.
Section 1?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Questions from members? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to thank the Swansons for coming forward and sharing their testimony with us. They drove about 3.5 hours to come up and share their story today.
Thank you for sharing your story with the committee.
Madam Chair, I have one more testifier on behalf of the bill, that is David Francis, who is the father of John Francis, and some of you may remember hearing the story of John Francis, which was told in the media in the last year or so, and I think David would like to share his story with the committee, and then that's the testifier's name. On behalf of the bill, I believe the law enforcement has some concerns they'd like to express, and the families and law enforcement will be meeting after this meeting to discuss those concerns to try to make sure that we can get a agreed-upon document.
Great. Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
David Francis with the John Francis Foundation. Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for the invitation to testify. Is the screen on?
Yep, hit it there.
My wife Linda and I are co-founders of the John Francis Foundation, named in honor of our son John, who went missing in the Sawtooth Mountains of central Idaho on July 15, 2006. The foundation is named in honor of our son John and also dedicated to making a positive difference in the world just as John did. We're an advocate for wilderness search and safety. We're currently working with the Swansons on their search for their son Brandon. And with Representative Seifert, the Speaker of the House, and staff, and the BCA, we've helped create Brandon's Law. I'm here this afternoon to speak in support of Brandon's Law. Part of our mission is also wilderness safety, providing information and training. You each have a safety kit, which my wife Linda put together during our search for John to help others go out in the wilderness safely. It has safety tips and also low technology signaling devices, a whistle, please don't blow that whistle inside, and a very reflective mirror for signaling for aircraft, helicopters who may be searching. Our son John was an All-American runner in Minnesota a Bible camp counselor in Idaho, a youth minister in Utah, and a mountain climber. Our 24-year-old son climbed to the summit of Grand Mogul, the Sawtooth Mountains of central Idaho. He achieved the summit July 15, 2006, but failed to return. Lynn and I flew to Idaho and met up with the Custer County Sheriff. The sheriff conducted a 29-hour hasty search. They failed to find our son, and the sheriff came to us and said, "David and Linda, you need to give your son up to the mountain." They packed up and rode out of town. We were thrown into darkness and despair. We thought that law enforcement and the public sector had their act together and they knew how to find missing persons and they were on the top of their game in search and rescue. That was not the case. We thought it was an Idaho problem, but we found out later that it's a national problem and a Minnesota problem. An unsuccessful search for a missing person, whether it's done flawlessly or poorly, when it ends unsuccessfully without finding the missing person, the family and loved ones are thrown into deep despair, grief, heartache, feeling helpless, hopeless, and abandoned. We gathered together as a family on day 4 after our son went missing, and it was obvious that neither local, state, nor federal agency would search for our son, John, so the burden of finding our son and bringing him off the mountain fell to us. So we began organizing the 120 people who had flown out to Idaho to search for John. Friends and family, some of the searchers from the official party came back. And for several days, we put hundreds of people up on the mountain and fortunately brought them all back safely. I received several calls. One was from Governor Pawlenty, who sent out DCA agents to work with us. Unfortunately, in Idaho, they were well outside their jurisdiction. But they were there for us and they acted as advisors. Patty Wetterling called me and said, "David, the Jacob Wetterling Foundation can help." And they sent out a search and rescue professional experienced search manager. Jeff Hossie from Search Rescue and Recovery Resources of Minnesota, too many R's in their name, Sarmin, came out on August 1st, which was Linda's birthday, and brought us structure, science, and safety to the search. This is Jeff on your right in the October search for John. This was about 40 days into the search, just before snow and ice forced us off Grand Mogul. This is early October. Jeff and I and search and rescue volunteers worked for 70 days. And on July 24th, 2007, we found John's remains and brought him off the mountain and home to rest in Minnesota. It's not an Idaho problem. It's a Minnesota problem. It's a national problem. As you just heard, on May 14, 2008, Brandon Swanson, 19 years old, from Marshall, Minnesota, got his car stuck in the ditch in Lyon County at the intersection of three counties, Lyon, Lincoln, and Yellow Medicine County. He made a decision to leave his car and walk to town to meet his parents. He never arrived. He disappeared. He hasn't been found since. The jurisdictional tug of war between the three counties lasted for 2.5 months. before Sheriff Jack Bezecki from Lincoln County said, "I'm taking charge. I'm going to be the lead investigator. I'm going to work on searching for Brandon." So, if you give out awards to county sheriffs, remember the name Jack Bezecki, Lincoln County. The Swansons did the same thing as the Francises did. They had hundreds of volunteers, family members, some search and rescue people, and they unsafely put them out searching the Yellow Medicine River in the spring when it was flowing high and fast. Because when the Lyon County Sheriff ended his 36-hour search, he said to the family, "Your son Brandon is in the river, probably stuck under a log, and he needs to bloat and float." And they stopped the search. So hundreds of people were searching the Yellow Medicine River. We met with the Swansons 2 weeks after Brandon went missing, Memorial Day last May. We helped bring some structure and safety to the search and brought out our search manager, Jeff Hossie, who is currently working with Lincoln County Sheriff and us and the Swansons on the continued search. The next search will occur March 21st of this month, assuming that the snow has melted. Missing loved ones cause heartache and grief and unresolved loss. If you've never met it before, I want to introduce you to unresolved loss today. Your loved one is missing. You don't know what happened to them. You can't find them, and you can't gather their remains and lay them to rest. Therapists sometimes call it ambiguous loss. It happens when people go missing. I would invite you to walk a mile in our moccasins. Think for a minute how you would feel if this were your child or adult child. And after a 2, 3, 4 day search, law enforcement came to you and said, "Give your child up to the mountain. Give your child up to the Yellow Medicine River. Give your child up to the wilderness. We can't find him or her, and we're finished." In our research for Brandon's Law, we found out that currently in Minnesota there are 800 unsolved missing persons cases. There were 800 unsolved missing persons cases in 2006. There are 800 unsolved missing persons cases in Minnesota today. There are 200 unidentified remains, and only a small number of them have DNA samples or dental records or skeletal x-rays on file. FBI audit of the NCIC, the National Crime Information Center computer, found that Minnesota was out of compliance with federal standards on missing persons cases. This was in the 2006 legislative report, and the information was provided by the BCA in a request for funding. The BCA and hundreds of others, about 400 people, attended a conference in Philadelphia hosted by the Department of Justice. And out of that conference, the presentations and workshops, came a model missing persons legislation. It has been adopted by 10 other states, the DOJ Philadelphia Model Missing Persons Legislation. It's even been adopted by New Jersey. Now, in Minnesota, New Jersey should be the butt of our jokes, not a model for legislation. 10 states have adopted the Department of Justice legislation. It's sometimes known as Project Jason. Jason Zolkowski of Omaha went missing 8 years ago. He was walking down the street in his neighborhood on the way to work. He disappeared and has not been found. His parents turn their grief into action, as many parents do, and they became legislative advocates. They took, Kelly Jolkowski was present at the Philadelphia conference in 2005. She took the model legislation and began developing teams of advocates and going from state to state, starting with her own state of Nebraska, to make them aware of the inadequacies of missing persons legislation in many states, getting them to consider adopting Project Jason legislation or the DOJ model. In our own personal grief and unresolved loss and experience helping develop Brandon's Law, the Swansons and the Francises and many others have come to the firm conclusion that Minnesota's missing persons laws are out of date and inadequate. Currently, they're a page and a half long. It's called the Minnesota Missing Children's Act. Currently, Minnesota has a page and a half of legislation covering missing persons with a focus on missing children. We're out of date. It's inadequate. We're here today to ask for your serious consideration on updating and expanding our missing persons. Brandon's Law was created to provide the following benefits to Minnesota, following provisions. It will update our current missing person statute, page and a half long. It'll help bring Minnesota back into compliance with national standards. Again, the FBI audit of the NCIC concluded that Minnesota is out of compliance, national standards. Our information processing, while adequate, is rudimentary. Many of us have more powerful computers at home than the BCA has dedicated to information clearinghouse of missing persons. Law enforcement lacks guidelines, although they're being provided by the BCA. Currently, the BCA is using the Department of Justice model legislation for local law enforcement training, so they're seeing it. They're being trained using the model legislation, but at this point it does not have the effect of law. Other states who have adopted the DOJ model legislation or Project Jason are finding that it helps them solve missing persons. It's an aid to law enforcement. It's an aid to closing missing persons and unidentified persons cases because it encourages or requires them to connect the dots. Local law enforcement information gets to the state clearinghouse, gets to the federal level, and also encourages them to collect DNA samples. They're free. The President's Initiative on DNA provides free DNA analysis and sampling and also collection of dental x-rays. Chester County Sheriff didn't ask us for any. My wife Linda carried John's dental x-rays in her bag for a year before we found John, and then she provided those to the coroner. Brandon's Law, in effect, adopts the National Department of Justice model legislation adopted by 10 other states. Fundamentally, and if nothing else survives from Brandon's Law, expanding it to cover missing adults will be a great achievement, will be significant progress, and supports the BCA clearinghouse that will aid in solving cases. And when I met with the BCA this week, I couldn't help but put my, I'm a former IBMer, that's why I have this blue pinstripe suit. I couldn't help but put my information technology hat on and say, is that all you have for the information clearinghouse? So it's a good start. It works, but when the BCA comes to you for future funding for the clearinghouse, please give them your consideration because it really needs to be expanded. It needs to be much more powerful than it is now. This is what the Department of Justice model legislation and federal standards require. They require, and this is what's in Brandon's law, it requires that law enforcement agency make no excuses. And right now they do throw out a lot of excuses when it comes to filing missing persons reports. There are no excuses. They will file a report, and that report will be contain the required information, again required under national standards. That will be sent to the BCA Clearinghouse, and the BCA Clearinghouse will send it up to the federal level, the National Crime Information Center, and NAMIS, which is the National Missing Adults and Unidentified. So they're two federal computers. And this way we connect the dots. Unfortunately, the missing persons system, information system in the United States is similar to pre-9/11 America. The information on the terrorists were in various computers. The dots were not connected. They hadn't shared the information. No one had analyzed it. And I think you heard the news on the other day that an Arabic transmission was deciphered on September 12th that said September 11th was D-Day for them. So connecting the dots and missing persons is vital to solving cases and finding missing persons. As we followed the Yellow Brick Road and met with representatives and senators, they've asked us basic and good questions. Why Brandon's Law? Why should we legislate? And I went back to my many years of corporate life and said, you know, good policy generally leads to good outcomes. Good laws encourage the kind of good behavior that we need when it comes to finding missing persons, because it's hard work. And effective organizations manage information effectively. Knowledge is power, you've heard that. Effective information management makes an organization effective. And we need more effectiveness in our law enforcement system. Implement best practices, you're going to yield success. We've seen that over and over again in our own organization. Effective information management, implementation of best practices. You do the right thing over and over and over again, and eventually you have success. And success in the world of missing persons is helping law enforcement to solve missing persons cases and unidentified remains cases. And as a member of a grieving family, the member of a club, that I and Linda and Annette and Brian Swanson never wanted to join, Brandon's Law will help us relieve human suffering. The suffering of families who've lost a loved one in the wilderness, in an urban environment, wherever. The families of the 800 missing persons cases that are unsolved, and those who unfortunately will follow in our footsteps in the future. Brandon's Law will help relieve human suffering and unresolved loss. So please give Brandon's Law your serious consideration. It's good law, it's good policy. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your story. Or Representative Seifert, anyone else?
No, I'm sure that's all I have on behalf of the bill, and I do believe we have someone from law enforcement and from the Bureau who would like to testify with concerns they have. As I mentioned earlier to the committee, the DE amendment does address some of the concerns, but there are further concerns they have, and the families will be meeting with them after the committee. I believe this will be going to finance down to represent PMAR's committee. If we don't have a fiscal note on it or anything, but we would like to move the bill on today and hear the concerns that law enforcement have.
Please come to the table and state your name for the record, and if you all want to come down so that we have the opportunity to see how many folks there might be. And Representative Mullery.
Good
just to let you know, before you came into the room, they did take out all the data practices stuff.
Oh, I knew that.
Okay.
It's going to happen.
All right. Go ahead. State your name for the record.
Madam Chair, Jim Franklin, I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, and very difficult to come before you at this time, having witnessed the testimony here. I can't even begin to tell you how many times that we have had death investigations and other kinds of things in my many years of law enforcement. And it doesn't get any easier dealing with the families and the victims than it is now. And I first off want to just simply say our deepest sympathy and apologies. We're still looking for Brandon, and Lord only knows what happens. Good Lord can give comfort, but we've got to find him sooner or later. We do have concerns that I will just be very brief on right now and try to highlight. But I just want to reiterate to this group, success comes in youth, and the IBM model was explained very briefly. In law enforcement, we use a five-part model. Number one, good people do the right thing. Secondly, good policy is absolutely essential. Third, we must train. Fourth, we must supervise. And fifth, we must discipline. And we must have those key components in order to be successful in whatever we do in our law enforcement endeavors. With that, I would just highlight this. We have an example here, one in Idaho, one case in Minnesota. There's been many other successful cases in Minnesota. Certainly the one that we have in Marshall needs review. Secondly, could we do better? The obvious answer is certainly. And up until today, hearing that this was a tri-county concern is the first that I was aware that that was a concern. I have talked with the Sheriff Jack in Lincoln County. He is very dedicated and passionate about doing what he can because he has taken the lead due to the fact of the river and many other factors, feeling that the search would ultimately be in Lincoln County and the discovery. We have concerns about the implications in the bill that has large fiscal costs for local units of government. And I just want to say, since the first of the year, 7 police agencies in the state of Minnesota have gone out of business. I also want to tell you that the sheriffs have to provide police service. I also want to tell you that the sheriff's offices get no more deputies to provide that police service. So what I'm here to tell you is not only do we have increased liability, responsibility in this bill, but we have diminishing resources by which to address those needs. Many of the parts that are in this bill are standard common practice, and I don't know that we take our practices and our procedures and our policies that we use in training and incorporate this into law. Every time we want to make a change, we have to come back to the legislature and ask you for permission to change a training practice. I don't think that's necessarily wise that we do that. There are several things in this bill that I will not take the time to point out now that are actually detriments and would hinder us from solving some of these criminal activities. And I have great concern about those. Third, we have a very difficult time sorting out people who want to go missing for whatever reason versus those who are missing for a valid reason. And having been in law enforcement for over 40 years, I can tell you I've had cases on both sides of that fence. Finally, we need to provide in this bill and in our investigative duties a process by which we don't give information to the family that would find the victim only, or the person that's missing only, for that person to become a victim of another criminal activity, a domestic relationship, or other type of activity that we have seen happen previously. These are concerns that we have with regards to this bill and how it's crafted and what it means for law enforcement in Minnesota. I will not go into greater detail for time consideration. We have addressed some of these things several years ago with the BCA, and I would yield my time at this point to Superintendent O'Malley at BCA to follow up with some additional comments.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tim O'Malley. I'm the superintendent at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I also will try to be very brief. We, as Representative Seifert started out by saying that, that this is a well-intended effort to improve how these situations are handled. This is a genuine attempt to make things better. The wording itself, there are some problems. You know, we don't, none of us want to have mandates that are impractical and might actually have unintended consequences rather than the opposite. So I think we can work through some of that. I have known David Francis now since July of 2006. I met Brian and Annette Swanson for the first time today. There is no doubt in my mind that we share the common goal of protecting citizens and finding people when we can. We at law enforcement broadly, but certainly I will make the pledge personally that I'm committed to these families and to the author to try and come up with a way that we can make this practical and workable. I know that these families are not in this. There can be no selfish motive. They are in this for the long haul, and they are in this as a forward-looking effort to try and improve what we all do. I think that we need to make sure that the means or the acts that we put in place, the mandates that we put in place, are reasonable, practical, and responsible in the long run. And I think with some time after this meeting and or after this hearing and some other times, we will work our best to try and come up with some legislation that makes sense for everybody. Right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Janelle Esposito, Director of the BCA, she oversees our, there's an awful lot that we could go into in terms of what's happened since 2006 when that audit took place and the changes that have gone. And I've testified before this committee before about the Missing Persons Unidentified Dead Project and the DNA and the matches that we've had two successful cases here in Minnesota where someone from the 70s was found in Florida, and because of our efforts to gather DNA from relatives, put it in this national database, we linked that. And that family now, after 20 or 30 years of the girl running away, now knows what happened. So there have been some successes, but I guess my recommendation, rather than dig into those, we need to talk, and Mr. Prince and I did meet earlier this week, and there are some changes that have taken place that I don't know that even he, who has studied this pre-art, are completely up to date on, and that's what we need to do, is see where we were a couple years ago, where we are today, and how we can have this forward-looking effort that they're so committed to and make that a reality.
Questions from members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. O'Malley or Mr. Franklin, in your carrying out searching for missing persons, you get to a point where it's a point of no return as far as your resources and things like that. And I know that in Wright County and other counties that I've dealt with sheriffs and people who have known in law enforcement, they come to a point where the cost of doing this becomes a diminishing, there's no return on it. But I'm just wondering, I know that in certain instances and in certain circumstances, they have a reserve force. They have people who are retired and are looking to help out in any way possible. And just wondering if you, in your capacity, utilize these people on a volunteer basis or be able to use their expertise and their knowledge and bring them into, and on a minimal cost. I know, like I said, that, you know, costs and resources are very much a strain item, especially in the economy today. But the utilization of volunteer, retired sheriffs, retired people in law enforcement, retired military people, being in the Air Force, being involved with the Air Force Reserve FPs, they are always willing and looking to be a part of it if they can be involved. Is there any way that you can utilize them, bring them into the picture without, you know, further diminishing or causing new problems?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, that's a very good question, and the short answer to your question is yes. A little bit longer version is, and you've asked several parts of that question. As an example, the sheriff of Mille Lacs County has spent over $100,000 looking for a missing person that had drowned on Mille Lacs. At some point in time, you simply have to say, how much can we afford to spend? This presents a problem that this body could do something about. When we have a forest fire in the state of Minnesota, we have a fund that we can go tap. when we have major types of things, is there a fund we can go tap? At what point does a county simply run out of funds, and where do we go? This is the dilemma faced by the local sheriff and the county board, who has a mandate to balance their budget, and where do I come up with those dollars? So part of this solution to doing a better job of finding people, investigating and things, is having a, lack of a better term, rainy day fund that we know we can tap into for those extraordinary, complicated cases. Secondly, your question about resource allocation. Absolutely utilized, and they are utilized in many different ways. One of the pieces that's missing here, and is certainly exemplified in this particular case, in which they've alluded to the tri-county discoordination rather than coordination, apparently, is bringing those resources together. We do that with a better job of training and then asset and resource allocation. The focus of our sheriff's summer conference this year is on exactly that topic. What resources do we have? How can we better allocate those? And secondarily, what is hindering us from crossing over the lines of our boundaries to help one another? And the cost issue is the one factor we have to resolve. How do I send personnel from one sheriff's office to another sheriff's office, impacting my budget? And those are cost issues that we have a problem that we have to deal with. But your suggestion is very valid, and it is pieces of that we do use now.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you know, we're just talking, not just talking local, as far as coordinating with three counties, so you're talking Lyon and Lincoln and whoever else, but some of these things, as was alluded to in earlier testimony, is a national thing. And we're talking the federal government and getting them involved and talking about federal resources that could be, I don't know, I haven't sat on this committee for about 6, 7, 8 years, so I'm not sure what's available from a federal standpoint as far as a rainy day fund or anything that you have available in your box of tricks, if you want to call it that, or box of resources that's available to go after and pull resources in from the federal level to help with this national, because it sounds like it's a national, 800 people missing nationally, not just here in Minnesota. So I'm just trying to kind of put the big picture in. Do you work nationally with the national law enforcement and the BCA works, I'm guessing you do, FBI and all that? Just asking that question.
Mr. Franklin.
Madam Chair, Representative, let me answer that question in two parts. The first part has to do with the manpower and the people and the resources, putting boots on the street in order to do certain kinds of things. Normally, federal assets will not come into play unless there is a federal jurisdiction of a crime or something across the state line, something of this nature. The closest case that comes to my mind is the murder case up in Crookston, Minnesota, and Fargo and Moorhead in that area, or Grand Forks. And that brought in federal resources. So normally federal resources do not come in on the ground without some type of intervention or involvement of some sort of federal criminal activity or something of that nature. Secondly, I'll ask Tim to address the database issues and how they interact with the federal and other law enforcement agencies that cross over from Minnesota to other parts of this country.
Mr. O'Malley.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there are resources available, and we have tapped into those at the federal level in order to coordinate across all states, whether it's from Amber Alerts to the Unidentified Dead and Missing Persons Project, and coordinate those. CODIS is the combined DNA database, so that when we have that, and it's not just DNA, it's dental records, photos, fingerprints is the fourth one. We try to get all those in there on both missing persons and unidentified and medical examiner's offices around the country. Now, the other thing that Executive Director Franklin mentioned, and when you ask about the resources available, if somebody goes missing, what do you do? A lot of this is raising awareness and having people. It's not always a question of resources. It's a matter of coordination. It's a matter of getting it done in a short period of time. And we have put on training. We plan to put on more, not just for missing children, but anybody who's missing.
I know of chiefs and sheriffs that I've met with, and we've laid out what we resources we can bring if they call us, so they know, they can plan in advance. They've gone to the big businesses in town and said, listen, nothing's happened now, but in the event that we were to need 200 searchers on an afternoon, could we talk about it now so I don't call you one day and you go, geez, I'd have to look at our union contract, talk to our HR director, and I'd have to call my boss in whatever town we're, you know. No, let's grease all that now. And a lot of that has taken place. Those are the kinds of planning and education and awareness that, you know, not every chief and every sheriff may know about that. But that's some of the things that we are doing and have really increased our efforts in the last few years.
Representative Johnson.
I'll pass it on, sir.
All right. Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, the chair renews her motion that House File 1242 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Finance with the recommendation that it be sent to Public Safety Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Seifert. Next on the agenda, Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, did you say as amended?
As amended. Representative Seifert, technically on the motion I didn't say as amended, so I do need to say as amended.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hansen, welcome to the committee. I'll move that House File 1097 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation that it be re-referred to the Public Safety Finance Committee. Welcome to the committee. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm pleased to discuss House File 1097 that has some prohibitions on discharging a laser at aircraft. It's a relatively short bill. I did ask, and I think you should have in your packet some supporting documents from Congressional Research Service on this relatively recent phenomenon of lasers being pointed at aircraft. This bill came because I have a constituent, Mr. Englund, who lives in West St. Paul and is also on the West St. Paul City Council, who came to me. He experienced this in his regular job, and I want to be clear that he is here. He's a member of the State Patrol, but the State Patrol officially is neutral on this bill. But he has the experience of having gone through this and is going to kind of relate the severity of the problem there. So, Mr. Englund.
Thank you.
Go ahead. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jim Englund, E-N-G-L-I-N. And as Representative Hansen said, I am a pilot with the Minnesota State Patrol Flight Wing stationed here in St. Paul.
Go ahead.
Thank you, ma'am. The bill that you have in front of you is language that fills a gap, if you will. As has been pointed out, there is a federal code currently under Chapter 2, Title 18, that relates to the destruction of aircraft, and I believe that's incorporated in some of your material. However, over the last, specifically in 2008, the State Patrol suffered three illumination events, if you will. In two of those cases, the parties were identified and arrested, and no charges were ever brought against the parties. The reason given from the USAG's office was that civil aircraft of a certain size, that the State Patrol aircraft, medevac flights, news gathering agencies, didn't qualify underneath the federal statute. To date, there's only been one federal case that's ever been prosecuted, and that was in California. I don't have a reason or an answer for you as to why it was prosecuted successfully in California and hasn't been throughout the rest of the country. These incidents aren't related to just Minnesota. Over the course of the last 4 years, there's been over 900 reported lasing incidents of aircraft, both commercial carriers and civil aircraft. But just to give you a little bit of idea of what it is that we're talking about, they're commercially available at OfficeMax or any other business supply, Walmart, Target, and it's just a simple pen light. In this particular case, this is a green light, and if you can see it over here, I'm not quite sure if you can see it on the walls behind you. This has a two AAA batteries in it, and I brought the package with you because I found it interesting that it's advertised as the most powerful legal green laser pointer available. It has a range of over 10 miles in just this one little simple pen. Some of you may have used these, the reds, the greens, the blues. greens tend to be or are classified as more powerful than the reds. There's sort of a grade system on them. The FDA actually regulates laser use, and they're graded on a 1 through 4, a 4 being a military or commercial application, a 1 being what you would find in a DVD or a CD player or maybe the kids' game systems at home. Simple pen lights such as this are rated as a 3A, which is the just one down from the top level. The problem that comes in the flight regime in which we operate, news gathering, medevac flights, and civil aircraft. For the most part, we're low and slow. We're less than 1,000 feet from the ground, and we're less than 100 miles per hour. It gives you the ability to track an aircraft in that flight regime fairly easily and fairly accurately as well. What happens, if you can imagine, probably one of the brightest flash bulbs going off directly in your face. If that were to happen today in a room like this, you'd blink it off. You may have some discomfort for a little while, but it would go away. You can imagine what the problem would be if you're in an aircraft, whether it be an airplane or a helicopter, in that low and slow flight regime. The effects are an opaquing, if you will, of the windshield of the aircraft. It becomes completely impossible. It's impossible to see through the windscreen at that time. You are disorientated, your eyes will blur, they will water, and the effects can last some time. In our particular operation with the State Patrol or electronic news gathering or medevac flights, we tend to hover quite a bit and fly pretty slow and low to the ground. So with that disorientation, there's a very real possibility that this simple pen light can cause a great deal of damage and a great deal of carnage, if you will, if we were to crash that helicopter or airplane. We were reasoned between when we brought those cases to the federal authorities. The FBI was very interested. They came out. They did their due diligence. They interviewed the parties. The parties readily admitted that what they had done was wrong. They knew it was wrong, but there was a disconnect between the federal law and the fact that there is no state law currently that prohibits this type of operation. It's been a long process, but with Representative Hansen's help, you have the language in front of you. It is fairly straightforward. It creates a 5-year felony for discharging a laser at an aircraft while in operation. It does have the exceptions in it for search and rescue, because these pens can be used as a search and rescue tool. Many hunters will carry these in their packs. And it has the exception for law enforcement for identification purposes as well.
Questions from members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. England, you fly for the state, not for the State Highway Patrol. I think that was your testimony that you do that. Who are you, besides coming under the department here in Minnesota, who is your hierarchy as far as where do you report to, not maybe you, but your department go to as far as the next level above that?
Mr. England.
Madam Chair, Representative, the State Patrol is a division of the Department of Public Safety, so that would be the next step up from my colonel, would be the Commissioner of Public Safety.
And
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. England, the Department of Public Safety would be under, would you say, the Department of Homeland, or would you say the Department of Defense?
Mr.
On a federal level.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know that the state agency would necessarily fall in a hierarchy necessarily underneath Homeland Security. I know we work hand in hand with so many different agencies, but I don't know that we take direction from anyone on the federal level.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, Ms. England, you mentioned in the bill here that you are under the Federal Aviation Administration. And so I'm wondering how you, flying for the state of Minnesota, you fall under public safety, and yet you're saying you're also under the Federal Aviation Administration, do you also fall under the Department of Defense, which is a federal level? That's why I'm asking the question.
Mr. England.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's sort of a dual track. Because we're pilots, we are underneath the regulation and rules as pilots underneath the Federal Aviation Administration. That's correct. And as well as our aircraft maintenance schedules, flight time per month. Outside of that, I don't know that we necessarily answer directly to them as an agency.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the Department of Defense is a very broad term, and I'm just wondering if we, Representative Hansen, you want to narrow that down? Because being in the military, the Air Force, we do weekend duty, and we have people that fly at C-130s. We fly helicopters with the Air Army Reserve, things like that. And I'm just wondering if you want to narrow that down a little bit so that you can be more specific, because you, as Mr. England, flying for the state troopers, you say you're part of this, but it doesn't give really a direct where you go back to as far as your final authority, and who can, and can you access federal law to make a case in regards to what we're talking about here? Will federal law also, because you're flying under the federal guidelines, Federal Aviation Administration, do federal guidelines have any impact on bringing justice to someone who does this to you as a flyer?
Mr.
A pilot, sorry.
Madam Chair, Mr. Representative, I'll try to read through that a little bit. Federal law currently is intended in the post-9/11 rush to protect airliners. Federal law, as it is currently written under Title 18, was intended to secure federal larger air carriers, if you will. There was a disconnect, and it was recognized that there was a disconnect between what was currently written in federal law and the gap that the state currently has there. In 2007, there was an attempt to rectify that, and there was a bill introduced by Keller of Florida and Forbes out of Virginia in the House of Representatives. It was entitled the Securing Aircraft Cockpits Against Lasers Act. It was recognized at that time that there was a gap there between state or federal definitions, if you will, and acts. Unfortunately, it was passed on a voice vote in the House of Representatives in 2007. But when the Congress adjourned, didn't have a Senate companion bill, and therefore, it was never the loophole was never corrected, if you will. So what that's led to is many states, and in some cases, local ordinances. In the case of Dallas, Texas, they actually have a local ordinance that prohibits this type of act. California, New York, Ohio, they have state statutes that cover these type of acts. More and more states and more local jurisdictions that have flight wings or are cutting an increase in the reporting of these types of incidences are going that way because there is that disconnect with the federal code. I don't have an answer for you, sir, as far as if it would impact, but I can tell you that the USAG's office here in Minneapolis twice wouldn't charge this type of act.
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Anderson,
I'm concerned that on the federal level, as Mr. England just referenced, that we are having comments coming over the airwaves from our lawmakers in Washington, D.C., that the tendency is to loosen up the definition of terrorists and those people who have brought, since 9/11, have brought some problems into our United States of America and our state. And I'm concerned that if we don't get this taken care of, not only here, but push further up to the federal level, and that we keep pushing, that it's not going to make a difference. We might get some difference here, but it's not going to happen if you cross the border here in Minnesota, Wisconsin, or Iowa, or wherever, if those states don't have it. And I'm just concerned that I'm sorry to hear that the federal legislation didn't go through to actually directly affect this piece here. So I hope as a law enforcement person there, if you have contact with others who deal with the federal, and myself included, will push to make this work on the federal level. So, Mr. Hansen, appreciate you bringing this forward.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, the chair renews her motion that House File 1097 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation that it be re-referred to the Public Safety Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Okay. Next bill on the agenda is Representative Champion. Members, we have 45 minutes left in the hearing, and any bill we don't finish in the next 45 minutes, we're coming back for at 6 p.m. tonight.
Representative Tantian, welcome to the committee. It's my understanding that this is being laid over for possible inclusion of the public safety omnibus bill. So go ahead, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bobby Champion, I am before you this afternoon as I have a bill that is an agency bill from MnDOT, and it is to deal with a challenge or problem that MnDOT has had at its various rest areas. You should have in your packet some pictures that we thought we would put together just to give you an idea of the challenges that MnDOT faces.
Representative Champion, it's my understanding that you have the A1 amendment, so I would move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order that that author would like it. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. Representative.
Thank you. And so this particular bill, in its amended form, will help address the issue that is identified by the pictures. People say that pictures are worth 1,000 words. They're your 1,000 words. If you look closely at those pictures, you'll see in the disposal areas, those things that did in fact make it into the trash can, you'll find residential doors, you'll find toilets, you'll find other things that are not supposed to be at this particular place of space. So we're trying to address that issue, my representatives here from MnDOT will also testify to that. They've seen a number of people put those things in there, and they called the police and law enforcement, sort of felt reluctant to do anything about it because there was a lack of clarity. So I will let my representative from MnDOT testify if that's okay, Madam Chair.
Yep. Go ahead. State your name for the record.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Rob Williams. I'm the Rest Area Program Manager for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And as Representative Champion mentioned, I'm here today just to ask for your consideration and action that would lead to legislation that would allow law enforcement officers to cite individuals that would litter at rest areas, drop household and commercial garbage at rest areas, consume alcohol at rest areas, and use the rest area for purposes that are other than what it's intended for. Many of these activities are currently prohibited already along roadways, but it's unclear as to whether current laws apply at our rest area sites. Now, we've heard from several of our district staff that law enforcement officers have been afraid to or refrain from citing individuals for dumping it at our rest areas out in the district, and so we're asking for this legislation to clarify the laws. We did an informal poll of our on-site custodians, and 29% of them witnessed firsthand the dumping of household and commercial garbage at their rest areas. 13 witnessed the discharge of sanitary waste at our rest areas. As for misuse of our rest areas, we've had times where we've had people living out of their vehicles for extended periods of time at the rest areas. We've had truck boxes left unattended without the cabs for extended time, as well as boat trailers and such. So we do have a problem at our rest areas, and we're hoping this legislation will allow us to have law enforcement help us with it.
Representative Cornyn.
Well, Madam Chair, on the testifier, on page 1.17, I'm a little upset with that language. That gives a lot of power to MnDOT to decide what is or isn't accepted. I have no problem with the examples he's listed, but it says unless specifically permitted on a case-by-case basis, that means that you get to decide what a person's doing, whether him and the kids are playing ball in the parking lot to refresh themselves or whatever is or against the law, and if it's not specifically listed, they really can't be removed for it unless it's a violation. So it's a little problematic for me. I was wondering how tied you are to that language from 1.17 to 1.20, because it leaves it wide open for just discretion of the official there and to decide what he or she wants to happen there.
Representative Cornyn, we're actually going to lay this over, so I would encourage you to work with them to see if you can work out language as we make our decision whether or not to put them in the omnibus bill. Go ahead. If you have any comments.
No, Madam Chair. I guess the only response is that we wanted some leeway in that would allow us to, for instance, sponsor events with that have a safety message related to them. Like 2 years ago, we had a joint project with Blue Cross Blue Shield on a due campaign to get people out of their vehicles to exercise at the rest areas. So we wanted to make sure that we weren't precluding some of these safety opportunities that we have at rest areas.
All right. Well, Representative Champion, I would encourage you to work with Representative Cornish to make sure we can fix whatever we need to fix. Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the witness, what's the current law or policy with regard to the consumption of alcoholic beverages at MnDOT rest areas?
Madam Chair, currently there's no laws that prohibit it at rest areas.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cole.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Champion, I think that may be another one we should talk about. I'm not sure that we want to necessarily preclude somebody from having a beer if they pull over on the side of the road and they're having dinner and the guy not driving after they flip their hamburgers or their bratwurst and they're taking a break from their time on the road. I'm not sure we want to tell them they can't have a beer, but let's have that discussion. Again, for the witness, Madam Chair, I guess I'm curious as to why MnDOT has these large garbage receptacles and leaves them unlocked at the rest areas. If you didn't have these large receptacles, people wouldn't have a place to dump toilets and other things. Help me understand why in the world we have these things and we have them unlocked.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, basically at our rest areas, we have smaller little receptacles around the sites, and we usually have one large dumpster for which the custodians gather the contents of the individual receptacles and dump them for weekly or biweekly pickup.
Madam Chair,
okay.
If I might. Also, it is my understanding that when you look at the number of rest sites, they have an aggregate number of around 20 million people that use these rest stops across the United States, or especially in the area. So that's one of the reasons for having the larger container as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Champion, I don't have a problem with them with having a lot. It makes sense to have a larger receptacle there, but you know, if we're going to empty the garbage cans and send somebody out there to do it once or twice a week, let's put a lock on these things instead of turning people into criminals. That's again, I know we're laying this over. We can talk about it some more. I just think there's some more work that needs to be done on the bill.
All right, thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right. Seeing none, the chair lays over House File 570 for possible inclusion in the public safety omnibus bill as amended. Thank you, Representative Champion.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next, Representative Chair. Yep. Representative Taft moves that House File 1162 be laid over for possible inclusion in the public safety omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, this is a very simple bill that's going to streamline the way that season fines get collected by the counties on Department of Corrections forwarded offender surcharges. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Lori Casper, who will give you some background.
Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lori Casper. I'm the Financial Services Director for the Department of Corrections. What we hope to accomplish with this bill is just kind of streamline some processes between the Department of Corrections, county courts, and the Department of Finance. And we summarize that in our handout, and I just want to reference that when we make reference to counties, we are talking about county courts. Currently, what we do is for offenders, we get notification on fines, fees, and surcharges. We separately maintain obligations for fines and fees and surcharges. Quarterly, fines and fees will be sent to the county court system, and the surcharge gets sent to finance with a notice to the county court. What's happening is there's a lot of difficulty reconciling because the county court system isn't getting the entire amount through their system. Notices get lost. What ends up happening is those offender records are difficult to reconcile. By sending all of the money to the court system, they can then maintain an accurate record of the offender obligation, and then they forward money, which they are doing anyway, to the Department of Finance. So it just kind of streamlines it and should save everybody some time.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, the chair lays over. Oh. No. The chair lays over House File 1162. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Representative Cole.
Is this going to have some kind of a physical impact on the courts or
we're talking about them getting money they're not going to have, some things that we need to call out at least, maybe end up in the Germany market.
Any comment to that?
Madam Chair, Representative, no, there is no fiscal impact. Ultimately, finance ends up with the money. This just redirects the process that it's going to go through the courts before finance gets it. And the courts are then able to reconcile the record with the offender account. Same amount of money gets deposited.
Representative Coles, I'm happy to lay it over, and then if Chair Paymar wants it, we can just send it on the way. I think we found two bills now that we've already laid over that are going to have fiscal notes that we're going to have to send on their way. And so I'm happy to do that.
Madam Chair, maybe we should just ask for fiscal notes. I thought I heard the testimony. I could have been mistaken. We don't need to rehash it, that the courts aren't getting all the money sometimes today. Maybe I was reading something and not hearing that correctly. So maybe we should just ask for fiscal notes. If there's not one, then it doesn't need to go there.
We'll do that.
Thanks.
All right. Further questions? All right, seeing none, the chair lays over House File 1162 for possible inclusion of public safety omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Kapp.
It is a good bill, Madam Chair. I like the bill. But
thank you, Representative.
Set it the right way.
All right. Representative Bingham, if you're not, if your testifier is not in the room, we certainly can go to Representative Mullery or myself.
Representative Bingham. My testifiers, Madam Chair.
Representative Bingham, go ahead.
Thank you. What House file? Oh, I have to move my bill.
At 1422.
Yep, to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Okay. Go ahead, Representative Bingham.
Thank you. House file 1422 is a bill that deals with financial crimes task force and oversight council. You know, I think that this is a very good council and task force, and I like the work they do, and I feel that sometimes their strengths aren't always used to the best of their ability, and I want the task force to be have a little bit more oversight. And so what this would do is it would change it to an advisory board and allow the Commissioner of Public Safety to take over, along with the BCA director, some of the oversight of it with advice from the advisory council. And with that, I can have Chief Sakari talk about some of the other things in the bill, and also kind of the benefits of doing it this way.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair and members of the committees, I'm Mike Sitari. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Edina, and I also serve as the Chair of the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force Oversight Council. As stated, the purpose of the bill before you is to change the role of the Oversight Council from managing and directing the task force to an advisory board. Current language gives the Oversight Council what I consider hands-on duties, such as developing protocols and procedures for investigating identity theft and financial crimes, developing the grant processes to accomplish those tasks, and also to draw up an operational budget. The members of the Oversight Council are police chiefs, sheriffs, attorneys from the county, state, and federal level, and then the private sector partners who work there, and we meet on a quarterly basis. And we have found out that trying to manage a statewide task force can be a daunting and time-intensive task. For example, with my other duties as a police chief, I find it difficult to create the time needed to address the issues that come before me, which I consider operational issues, as Oversight Council business, such things as lease issues for office space, liability insurance for the task force and the board, and even contract issues for the support staff of the task force. With the present makeup of the board, we have not been able to get a quorum at our last two meetings. The task force and the Oversight Council are a work in progress, and we have had our share of growing pains. We've had turnover due to retirements, transfers, and for some even just a loss of interest in both the council positions and the task force, so we're looking for more stability in both bodies. The proposed language would better situate the task force to address financial crimes on a long-term basis. The operational duties of the council would be delegated to the Commissioner of Public Safety, who would then rely on advice and guidance from the advisory board. And this proposal was unanimously approved by the Oversight Council members at the last meeting. We feel the task force would best be served with what we call an anchor tenant to provide stability and consistency in the operations. And what we're talking is a core agency that we can rely on to be the backbone of the task force. Right now, it's a variety of agencies and members, and there's been some turnover due to budgets and other considerations. We feel the BCA, under the Commissioner of Public Safety, is the best fit for this with its statewide jurisdiction and its field offices. The bill also fine-tunes the membership on the Oversight Council to allow more flexibility in filling the positions and provide the necessary expertise to provide advice to the Commissioner. I've been involved with the task force since inception. I think I started in 2002, and this bill is a step forward to improve the way we address the fastest growing crime in Minnesota, and that's identity theft and financial crimes.
Questions from members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sitari, I didn't catch who is in charge, or who is the executive director, or who is the person that's heading up the task force, or the Oversight Council right now, and I guess whoever it is, why are we changing the name? Didn't the council itself work in the past? It sounds like you've got a lot of people that are part of it and have left because of disinterest, and so I'm just wondering what the person at the top is doing not to keep it together.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I wouldn't say a lot have left because that I am the chair of the Oversight Council. But over the past few years, the variety of members, the law enforcement members have retired, others have moved to different positions. And on the language, it's very restrictive on who can be on there. For example, it has to be a sheriff or a member on the task force. We just had a sheriff retire from Sherburne County. They also withdrew their person from there, so we're struggling. How do we fill that position when we don't have a second sheriff member on the task force? So these are operational issues that I think we better serve. We have quicker response from the commissioner and the BCA doing the day-to-day duties, and then relying on the Oversight Council or the advisory board for more of a strategic viewpoint on where they go.
Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other thing I'd like to reiterate is I think, and just as Chief Sitari said, is that this is a better option for folks to advocate for what they need. And this is, like I said, I think they do very good work and worthwhile work. So I just think having the access is a better spot for them to be able to do their jobs, too.
And your second testifier, Representative Bingham.
I'll introduce myself. I'm Bob Johnson. I'm the Anoka County Attorney. I've been a prosecutor for about 40 years. All this started about 10 years ago when, outside a Senate hearing, Judy Cook accosted me and asked me why we weren't appropriately prosecuting. I can tell others have been accosted by Judy Cook. Why we weren't prosecuting financial crime. So we pulled together bankers, retailers, representatives of those industries, law enforcement, and prosecutors. And I came to learn of the size of the financial crime that was going on 10 years ago. We learned that particularly the retail industry, saw patterns. They saw hundreds and even millions of dollars in thefts that were being accomplished by organized crime that we weren't able to see in the way our law enforcement system is structured. Now, understand that the police look for crimes within their particular city. So they do a little bit in one city, and they go to another city, and they go to another city, and another city, and each city doesn't see very much. But when you pull it all together, you're talking about serious money. We had difficulty in terms of prosecuting, investigating, and prosecuting those cases because, as Mary Meyer said, who was working originally with regard to this, she was an officer in Woodbury, and she'd start working a case, and that case would have tentacles that would go out to many other cities. She'd start putting together a big case, and her chief would say, Mary, what's wrong? Don't we have enough crime here in Woodbury to concentrate on just the Woodbury crimes? Our law enforcement system's not structured to take care of multi-jurisdictional crimes, which in the financial crime area are significant, very significant. This whole effort has had a troubled past, if you will, because it started out just a loose organization of law enforcement agencies trying to work together. a few years ago, a number of years ago, it received some legislative recognition. It kind of limped along for a period of time under this concept of where we would have this separate task force funded by the legislature. The U.S. Attorney believed in it so much, he actually funded it to the tune of over $1 million through forfeiture. And we were pulling these people together, law enforcement agents from the various cities, to work on these multi-jurisdictional cases. They're very significant cases, much more than you'll see with the individual ones that occur in a city. One of my investigators, I happen to have six investigators in my office, when I was talking to her about another matter, asked me to contact the U.S. Attorney about a case that we put together to go up to the U.S. Attorney's office, where we had 22 victims and over $1 million of offense. Typically, the response when these people go to law enforcement is that it's a civil matter. They don't, law enforcement typically doesn't look at these as criminal matters. They're used to what we call street crime, you know, the assaults and the robberies and the burglaries. They don't really understand that. This is what I've been telling the commissioner in a very minor way for some years, that we have to go back and rethink the way we do law enforcement in Minnesota. And we're operating under a model that's 150 years old, for heaven's sake. The criminals have gotten kind of sophisticated over that period of time, and they operate across jurisdictions all the time. This is a very small step towards that, where we take this little ad hoc unit, and I think you'd even talk about the drug and gang strike force or task force, and think about whether that model is still appropriate, and fold it into a state agency, which is what we're doing here. We'll put it into BCA. But I challenge all of you to really rethink about the way that we do law enforcement in this state. You know, I travel a lot around the country. I've even done some international work, and I'll tell you, a lot of other places have rethought the way they do law enforcement. We don't do a very good job here in Minnesota. We just are content with the old model of 87 county attorneys and all these hundreds of police departments and operate in their own little zones. Step back and think about how we should be doing it in the year 2009 as opposed to the year 1870. This is a small but positive step.
Representative Bingham, I would appreciate members' support on laying this bill over for possible inclusion. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there a fiscal note for this?
Representative Bingham, has there been a fiscal note requested on this?
No, there has not been.
Representative Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Bingham, you're going to ask the BCA to take over the responsibility of this project as an advisory council, I take it, and you're going to be looking at, I would think, some costs being affected because the BCA or whoever else is going to be involved is going to have to put some people and make them take over this. But and you're only going to ask them to do a May, and I'm understanding from what your testimony is, it almost should be a must because we're not catching criminals as fast as we should be. And it sounds like we're behind the eight ball by about 150 years.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dave Bjerga, B-J-E-R-G-A, and I'm the Assistant Superintendent at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. In response to your question, there is no fiscal note attached to this. Currently, the task force commander is a BCA employee. And he's a retired IRS agent, highly respected. We're able to bring him on board. He's paid through the funding for the task force. We do have one agent assigned to the task force. He's been assigned now from the task force to a mortgage fraud unit at the U.S. Attorney's Office. And at this point, this bill doesn't really say that BCA is going to be taking over the task force, or we will have the oversight of it. I will be on the board, on the advisory board, that would make recommendations to the commissioner. Actually, this bill passes a lot of the oversight council responsibility onto the commissioner with advice from the board. That's really what this bill does. At this point, we're not asking for a fiscal notice for money to put agents on the on the task force.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just the last kind of a point you don't even have to answer. Did you guys help with bringing Bernie Madoff to council?
I wish he would have.
Seeing no further questions, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, the chair lays over House File 1422 for possible inclusion in the public safety omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative. Representative Mullery. Keep in mind, Representative Mullery, we have 15 minutes left in this time slot. We have three bills, counting yours, on the agenda. So if you don't want to come back at 6.
Madam Chair, I think we on this side of this table, we can move this very quickly. Madam Chair, I would move House File 525 for passage and referral to Representative Hornstein's committee.
Oh, has Representative Hornstein requested this bill? We did not get any requests, Representative Smollett.
Madam Chair, we asked him and we got a note, I believe it was this morning, that he'd like to see it.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Could we dismiss the Republicans so we don't have to ask any questions?
Well, Representative Anderson, you are always free to get up and move about as you so choose.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, Madam Chair, this just expands the current Ignition Interlock Pilot Program that we put into law before. It was in Hennepin and Beltrami counties. I believe there were 70 people that participated, I think, or something very close to that, and there were only 3 failures, I believe. I was at a large meeting in Hennepin County about a month and a half ago about the drug court there, and they indicated that this was probably the most successful program they had, and they just wished that it could go statewide and that somehow there'd be funding so more people could participate. Right now, the people, in order to participate, have to pay themselves, and that holds people back. But they had such success with this, they encouraged that we expand it statewide. And Madam Chair and members, we have a witness here.
Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is June Ryan. I'm the Impaired Driving Program Coordinator within the Office of Traffic Safety in the Department of Public Safety. In my role, I have been managing the project of Ignition Interlock in the counties of Hennepin and Beltrami counties. And the current pilot program will expire July 1st of 2009. So we are hoping that maybe this will go statewide. This bill will extend the pilot to the remainder of the state. And if you have any questions, I'd be willing to answer them.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Ryan, the cost of the interlock devices, are those paid by the offender?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, the ignition interlock device is required to be paid with a monthly fee that the participant must pay.
One more question.
Representative Szymanski.
Is there any cost or expenditure on the local law enforcement to monitor these devices?
Ms. Ryan.
Madam Chair, Representative, no, there is no cost to monitor the device. Right now it's being monitored by, no cost. There's probation is required to monitor the device, and it is a voluntary thing, so it is up to the probation agency whether they want to, whether they're willing to monitor the device if a person chooses to be on ignition interlock.
Madam Chair, actually talked to the probation officer in charge of that program in Hennepin, and they said that they saved an awful lot of money by doing this.
Representative Paymar.
I just saw that a fiscal note came in on this. I didn't have a chance to read it. Do you know what it was?
Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, yes, it's 0.
Okay.
All right. Further questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Mullery renews his motion that House File 525 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Transportation Policy and Transit Oversight Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Mullery.
No.
Representative Hilton, would you like to move your bill? Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 1301 be laid over for possible inclusion in the public safety omnibus bill. Representative Wilson, for your bill. Thank you, Madam Chair. With me is the person who brought me the bill, and I'd like them to talk about it. Please just state your name for the record and welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Haas. I'm the Director of Community Corrections in Rice County, Minnesota, which includes the cities of Faribault and Northfield, and others, of course. I'm here to testify on behalf of the bill. A very brief history and one war story. The history is that the Community Corrections Act has been around since about 1972. The county attorney in one county rendered an opinion recently that restricted the applicability of apprehension orders issued by probation officers to the county where they were issued, which for us means if a person on probation, is violating the terms and conditions of that, and it's a serious violation, we issue an apprehension order and have them picked up and brought back to court to answer to the judge. Under the county attorney's interpretation, in this one county, if the offender is violating those conditions outside of our county, we can't pick him up. So the proposal before you is to simply clean up the language of the Community Corrections Act to make it clear that those apprehension and detention orders are valid outside the county where they were issued, anywhere in the state of Minnesota. And I have one very quick story. We had a man on probation, a sex offender. One of the conditions of probation is no contact with minors. He leaves Rice County, goes into, I believe it was Goodhue County, is stopped at a traffic stop for like no taillight or something. The officer who stopped the car that took the driver out ran a check on him, found out he was on probation, noted that he was with two teenage girls. So he called the probation officer, and the probation officer issued an order. Unfortunately, that order wasn't valid because the Rice County probationer was in the neighboring county, over in Red Wing. That was a serious violation of probation, but it didn't happen to be a crime, technically speaking, so the police couldn't hold him, and without our order being valid, we had to let him go. That's not a good situation for public safety, so I would urge your serious consideration of the changes to the language in the Community Corrections Act so that it's very clear to anybody who reads it that those orders are valid outside the county where they are issued. Thank you.
That's it, Madam Chair. Thank you. And Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't catch your first name.
Jim.
Jim? In the bill, it talks about a CCA county. How many CCA counties do we have in the state of Minnesota? How many different ones are there?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, there are 33 counties covered by the Community Corrections Act. And those 33 counties cover about 85% of the probation population, the people on probation. So they're mostly the larger counties.
Sir, a CCA county differs from another county in what way? They have a better probation system or a better system than another county? And why do we have all these different, why don't they all come on board if the CCA is so much better than one or the other?
Mr. Haas.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, the differences are lost to history for me, but it's mostly having to do with the consolidation of services. So in the CCA county, we cover everything from the juvenile who steals a Snickers bar to an adult sex offender. Anybody who's on probation or on supervised release, they're ours. In other counties, it may be split between the State Department of Corrections and the County Probation Department. That's the key difference.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
So, the cost savings to the taxpayer for a CCA versus a non-CCA?
Madam Chair, actually, Representative Anderson, we actually did have a hearing about the difference between the three probation types that we had here in the committee, and we're not going to get through the last bill, and we're going to have to come back at 6 o'clock, but I'd be happy to talk with you about the difference between CCA counties and regular counties
okay.
as much as you'd like.
Thank
We're
you.
Not going to solve that in this bill.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for the testifier or for Representative Hilton? Is there anybody in the audience that wishes to testify on House File 1301? Seeing none, Representative Hilton, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would like the committee to lay a House File 1301 on the table for a possible inclusion in the public safety omnibus bill.
The bill is laid over. And again, Representative Hilton, you have the next bill?
Yes.
House File 1235.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
House File 1235 is about aggregating factors, and I do know that there's someone in the audience that wants to testify in opposition as well.
Okay.
So, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Scott Hutsey. I'm head of criminal division of the Dakota County Attorney's Office. Very briefly, by way of background, the point of this statute is to clarify the legislative intent to allow conduct underlying a crime to be considered by juries and by the courts in setting upward departures in extremely serious cases. The sentencing guidelines were enacted in 1980. Most sentences are imposed according to a grid that are based on both the criminal history score and the severity level ranking of the particular crime that we have in Minnesota. The guidelines specifically provide for upward sentencing departures for crimes that are much more serious than the typical offense in a particular category. And specific bases for departures are set forth in the guidelines. They are also set forth by appellate court decisions. And any aggravating circumstances in Minnesota have to be found by a jury, and then the judge has the discretion whether to follow that jury recommendation. And for the past 25 years, the Minnesota appellate courts have been able to look at the conduct underlying the crime of conviction to determine if there are substantial and compelling circumstances to allow an upward departure, that is, that it's much more serious than the typical crime in that category. And in fact, as a little bit of history, in the late 70s, the governor then, I believe it was Wendell Anderson, vetoed an early version of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines because there weren't serious enough provisions in there to deal adequately, he felt, with upward departures for very serious crimes. However, in 2008, there were two decisions by the Minnesota Supreme Court that I fear in many ways spelled the death knell for upward sentencing departures and in fact caused significant confusion for both the trial courts and for practitioners. In a case I had, the trial court in particular commented about three times that the trial court did not understand the appellate decisions and it made it very difficult for the court. One example that is clear in Minnesota is State versus Kelvin Jackson. This was a Ramsey County case. It was an aggravated robbery where an individual broke into the home of an elderly individual. The perpetrator was armed with a pistol, not only robbed the elderly individual, but beat him severely in the face with the pistol, caused a blow-off fracture of the orbital socket, very serious injuries. The jury found that there were aggravating circumstances. The trial judge followed that and gave the individual an upward sentencing departure. However, when it got to the Supreme Court said, well, the beating was actually a separate crime of third-degree assault. And even if that had been charged, which it wasn't, there could not be a separate sentence for that because under Minnesota Statute 609.035, Minnesota's double jeopardy statute, only one crime in a course of conduct can be sentenced, and that's got to be the more serious crime. And so the Supreme Court said, essentially, damned if you do, damned if you don't, you cannot have an upward departure in this type of circumstance. Similarly, we had the case in Dakota County of State versus Daniel Jones, which we litigated for about 4 years at the appellate level, two times to the Court of Appeals, one time to the Supreme Court, involving Daniel Jones, who used methamphetamine with three friends. He took them to a party. One of the friends was a 16-year-old female. She was suffering a severe drug overdose from the drugs. He told everyone he would take her back to his house to help her and take care of her. He took her back to his house. By the time she got there, she was semi-conscious and had to be carried into the house. Jones proceeded to have sexual intercourse with her and did not get her any help, although her symptoms progressed. When her two friends arrived at the house about 2 hours later, she was not breathing. Jones would not let them call 911. so they did CPR on her, rushed her to the local hospital in Burnsville, but she was pronounced dead at the hospital. Jones was convicted of criminal sexual conduct in the third degree and felony endangerment and neglect. He was sentenced on the criminal sexual conduct. Essentially, when the trial court departed up for the criminal sexual conduct, the Supreme Court basically said, well, allowing the 16-year-old to die was conduct underlying the felony neglect and endangerment. It was not conduct related to the third-degree criminal sexual conduct, and therefore there could not be an upward departure on those grounds. When that case was remanded to the district court, a district court judge said he could not understand what the Supreme Court was doing, and therefore he did not allow the matter to go ahead to a sentencing jury to determine aggravating factors because he felt the Supreme Court would simply reverse it anyway. And so what this bill will do is this bill will clarify the law that allows district courts and juries to consider the conduct underlying the course of conduct, since only one offense can be sentenced in a course of conduct. And this has been reviewed by the Criminal Law Committee as well as the Board of MCAA and approved. And we would, Madam Chair and members of the committee, ask that this be passed on.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You said it was reviewed, I take it, by the Criminal Law Committee of the Bar Association. What was reviewed doesn't mean they approved it, rejected it, or anything. So what was their opinion?
Madam Chair, Representative, just to clarify, this was the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Oh. The Criminal Law Committee did approve it, and the board did specifically approve this.
Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, of the County Attorneys Association.
That's
did the Bar Criminal Law Committee look at it, or?
No, that's, Madam Chair, Representative, this was looked at by the County Attorneys Association.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, what's the motion for this bill?
To be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Any other questions for members of the committee? Anything else, Representative Hilton?
That's it, Madam Chair.
Is there anybody in the audience that wishes to testify on House File 1235? Please approach the testimony stand and state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is John Stewart. I'm the State Public Defender. I believe this bill is here because the Supreme Court didn't support the prosecutor's trial strategy in two cases that have been discussed here for about a minute each. These Supreme Court opinions are each in the area of 20 double-spaced pages. When you go to the Supreme Court with one of these cases, you get an hour for both sides to present. So I'm a little concerned at the possibility of you having to come back and talk about this at 6 o'clock tonight. What I want to say is that I've been a defense lawyer here for 32 years, and I've seen lots of Supreme Court cases that I didn't agree with. But I don't come over here to try to get you to sponsor a bill to reverse a Supreme Court case. There are also four Supreme Court cases pending right now about how aggravating factors are used in sentencing. The Supreme Court has been working on this issue. If you look at State v. Jackson, you'll see that five cases are cited in the majority opinion going back to 1981. They concern a law that was 609035 that was part of the original criminal code since 1963. So we've got a law that goes back 46 years. We've got case law going back 28 years. We've got four cases pending right now. But the prosecutor would like you to take care of this. I would respectfully urge you not to do it. I believe that what this bill would do would be to create more trials, more appeals, require more bed space. It would completely open the door for any kind of fact to be used to support enhancement of already very long sentences. In this Jackson case, the prosecution had got a sentence on this case of 105 months. If they had charged it to include the burglary, they would have gotten a sentence of 162 months, but they felt that by not charging the burglary, they could get the court to double the 105-month sentence based on the fact that the crime was part of a burglary. It happened in the victim's home. And that's what happened, and the Supreme Court said, no, if you want the extra month from the burglary, you've got to charge it, which they didn't do. So now we're here, and you're being asked now in this short time to think about all this and then to reverse all these Supreme Court decisions. And I would respectfully urge you to let the Supreme Court decide its four current cases. Let the Sentencing Guidelines Commission work on this. If you still have a problem next year, then I will probably remain mum, but right now I just don't think you should do this.
You have it on record.
I might send one of my friends up.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom, anything else?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I would like the committee just to lay this over. I think that this is absolutely an issue that this committee should at least be aware of, and so I just ask that you lay it over.
Okay. Any other questions from members of the committee? Anyone else wishing to testify in the audience? Okay, bill is laid over. And Representative Jackson, I do need a I do need a motion to approve the March 10th minutes. Would you be willing to do that? So moved, that's fine. Thank you. Any questions about the minutes? Those in favor say aye. Opposed, aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries, and we are adjourned.